Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews, a licensed therapist and professor of psychology here in Anchorage. This is my first live episode, and I'm really excited to be joining the Line One team. Today, our goal is to take some of the mystery out of mental health care. Many people know they're struggling or know someone they care about who is struggling, but they feel unsure where to turn. Should I see a counselor, a psychologist, a psychiatrist? What's the difference? And how do you know what's right for you? Mental health care isn't one size fits all, and that's actually a really good thing. Different professionals bring different training, different perspectives and tools, and understanding those differences can make it easier to take the first step towards support. Today, we're joined by three mental health professionals: Roxy Powell, a licensed marriage and family therapist at Coastal Wellness and Counseling here in Anchorage; Dr. Sandra Mitchell, a licensed clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist at Psychology Services of Alaska; and Dr. Ebony McLean, a licensed professional counselor at Ebony Counseling, Consulting, and Supervision. Roxy, would you like to start by introducing yourself and sharing about your background?
Yeah, thank you, Monique. I'm Roxy Powell, and so my background is actually in biology is where I started out, but came over to mental health when I graduated Regent in university in 2022, so I'm a little newer to the field. I have a master's in marriage, couples, and family counseling, and I'm a nationally board-certified counselor. I work mostly with couples and some families and individuals.
Thank you, Roxy. Dr. Mitchell, would you share a bit about your background and the work you do?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Andrews, for inviting me. I did my undergraduate degree in psychology, and then I did a terminal master's in clinical psychology. Can't do a lot with that, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to take the doctoral plunge, but I fell in love with neuropsychology during my master's program, and I completed a doctoral degree at the University of Florida, specializing in neuropsychology, and internship at the Connecticut VA, and then a postdoctoral residency at the New Mexico VA.
Thank you. And Dr. McLean, would you introduce yourself and share about your work?
Sure. Thank you for having me. I guess I'll say I started out actually in elementary education, working with little kids, and then decided I wanted to go back to school for counseling. So I have a master's in clinical counseling and a doctorate of psychology. And I will say I've been in the field. I'm celebrating this year 20 years as a therapist and 27 years in the field itself. And so I have a pretty extensive background in medical psychology. I've been a professor across three universities for about 14 of those 20 years. And so I'm just, I'm excited to be here. I'll just say that.
Thank you. Before we start, I'd like to share briefly about why this conversation matters here in Alaska. Mental health challenges impact about 1 in 5 adults in our state. So, in addition, Alaska continues to have one of the highest suicide rates in the country. And for many people, especially those living in rural or remote communities, access to care can be limited. Understanding the different kinds of mental health professionals available, including options like telehealth, is one important step towards reducing any barriers that someone may have and increase access to care. Okay, you all come from different professional backgrounds, but you're doing similar work. I'm really interested in what brought you to your profession. How about we start with Dr. Mitchell?
Okay, so I became interested in psychology at a pretty young age, probably around middle school, doing some reading, lived in a pretty rural area, and started reading about Freud, of all things, which is kind of weird when you think about it for a 12 or 13-year-old. And I had also been pretty observant about how different people were, even people who come from the same families with the same parents. I also had my maternal grandmother had been diagnosed in her 20s with schizophrenia. It was very well managed. She was high functioning, but that was also intriguing for me. And that's kind of what led me towards psychology as an undergraduate.
Thank you, Dr. McLean. What brought you?
Oh, well, I will say I started out as an elementary educator, and those are very special people, I will say that. And so I decided that it really was not for me. I was trying to find myself. I came from a family of educators. My mother was a professor of English, and so superintendents, all kinds of educators, right? So I thought this was my natural path. But what I discovered is that I enjoyed counseling more. I started out as what we call a clinical associate, and I worked residential treatment and outpatient, and just kind of discovered that this was the joy that I was missing of smaller groups. And actually, I was working with children who are in what we call a residential acute diagnostic unit. And I had one of the therapists I was working with tell me, "You're a natural at therapy. I don't know if you realize you're doing therapy with these kids. I've been listening to you." And so it just made me think about that. And so I went back to school a few times.
Roxy, how about you?
Yeah, so I started out my career in biology, doing research and working in museum studies. But when I married my active duty husband, things really changed for me. So just having this experience of military life, really frequent deployments, a lack of control being in the military. I felt that we didn't have a lot of control over decisions. Then it just got compounded by just that average struggle of a new family and being in a new marriage. And so it set me on a journey for my own mental health and really reaching out and getting some help there. And I found through this incredible counselor how much it changed me and then changed my family system totally. And so I was like, I got to get into this. So I went back to school and decided this is where I want to be.
Wow. Well, Roxy, you are a marriage and family therapist.
Yes.
So many people might assume you only work with couples. How do you usually explain your role?
Yeah, I talk to people about how their symptoms or maybe the problems they're coming in with may have something to do with the system misalignment within their life, like their family systems, maybe a parenting system or their sibling systems. And so I work to kind of help in those areas of deficit and work in the relational pieces of their life.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mitchell, often when people hear the word psychologist, they picture something very specific. How do you describe your role when someone asks, what do you do?
So I work pretty exclusively in neuropsychology. So it's a specialty field within clinical psychology. You know, a psychologist is a doctoral degree, and we focus on the way in which people manage their moods, their relationships. Psychologists are also trained to do assessment, so things like intelligence testing, learning disabilities, ADHD evals. But people tend to come and see me because they're having problems with their thinking, their memory. I still do assessments for things like IQ and intellectual disabilities and learning disabilities. But the the majority of what I do is looking at brain behavior relationships and doing assessments in terms of how people are, how their memory, their thinking, how all of that's working. And oftentimes, I'd say probably 50% of my practice is working with older adults who are concerned about dementias like Alzheimer's, after stroke, brain injuries, things that have made an impact on their ability to think and function. So those are, that's the majority of the people that I see in my practice.
Dr. McLean, licensed professional counselors are often one of the first points of contact for people seeking mental health care. How do you describe your role when someone might feel like they don't know where to start?
So I think my role is interesting because I'm also a doctor of psychology and a licensed professional counselor, which means my degree is higher than my license, right? And so a lot of times I have to explain that to people because the assumption to the general public is when you hear the word psychologist, you automatically think licensed professional or a licensed psychologist, right? And not a licensed professional or counselor, rather. And so for me, I do have to do a little explaining about my background. And I often describe my role as really here to help with change, right? I look at myself as a change agent. I make sure that my clients know that they are the expert on their own lives and that I meet them where they are. And so when I describe my role, I tell them that you're the person who's actually in charge of your progress and you're empowered to do that. I'm the vessel you work through. And that's how I view myself in my role.
Wow, thank you. What do you find people are most nervous about when they reach out for therapy? Dr. Mitchell, Dr. McLean, or Roxy?
I think there, at least in my world with families and couples, there's a lot of concern about feeling blamed as one part of the system. And so there can be some hesitancy reaching out and wanting to start that process.
Okay, Roxy, what would you want to share with someone if they're feeling stuck or overwhelmed or really unsure if their concerns are serious enough?
Yeah, I kind of believe if you've got that intuition that something's off, let's check it out. And so really not trying to measure is it big enough, but just noticing that there's something that's saying I need to check this out and coming in, then we can guide you from there.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ebony, if stigma had a voice, what do you think it would say?
I love that question. I believe, because I actually wrote my dissertation with, and I did it with homelessness, and stigma was a huge part of working with women in homelessness. I would say shame. If it had a voice, it would say I'm afraid and I'm ashamed, and that's what I come across most often.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Mitchell or Roxy, what do you think stigma would say?
Man, that was a really good answer. Shame is probably,
I think in my practice, it's fear.
Yes.
Because so many of my folks come in and they're worried about cognitive decline. There's some of that that is expected and normal, a normal part of aging. But many of the people who come in have watched family members struggle with a dementia like Alzheimer's disease, and they become really hyper aware of what we often consider to be normal age-related changes, being able to find that word in conversation, walking into a room and not remembering why you went there. And this is a pretty common thing that happens as we get older. But when you have that family history, the fear that that's, you're going to be like the parent, I think that often makes people delay coming in for evaluations. But oftentimes we can give people hope, hope that they're actually looking pretty good, or if there is a problem, there are more treatments available. And also being able to talk to families about how to plan for the future and putting these things in place. So I think that's probably the most common thing I see is fear.
Okay, and so with stigma, We have fear, we have shame, and we've heard Dr. Mitchell share how she combats that a little bit in her practice. How do you push back against stigma, Dr. McLean?
I work from an existential perspective, right? And so I believe that when people come in, we're making meaning and purpose, trying to figure out what's meaningful for them, what's purposeful for them. And I usually will tell them that my mantra is, I'm afraid and I'm doing it anyway. Because that's how I live my life, quite frankly. And so we start there with the fear. We know that it's, you know, it's a thing that can actually propel you forward, or it can limit you or stagnate you in your growth. And so I look at fear as something, I ask my clients, how can we motivate you with this fear? How can your fear be purposeful? How can it be useful? Even with shame, right? Like you're feeling ashamed here, you have some shame. Let's talk about the difference between appropriate guilt and shame, right? And toxic shame. And this is where, quite honestly, that elementary education degree serves me. Because I spend a lot of time educating my clients so that they may be empowered in their everyday lives.
All right. And Roxy, how do you push back? How do you combat stigma?
Yeah, I think as I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about just the small voices that kind of come up for people and where the root of that's coming from. And that's often where we're hearing voices of people we really care about in our lives and from our past, that maybe there's been a seed of doubt. And so that's part of that pattern, and recognizing, hey, man, when that fear comes up, there is this little voice inside of me that's been there for a while, and we're tackling that small voice.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's helpful for people to understand the differences and similarities between mental health professionals? Let's start with Dr. Mitchell.
I think that it's important for people to understand that we all have excellent training and specialties and specialty focuses. As a psychologist and a neuropsychologist, you know, those kinds of evaluations are only available through someone who is a clinical psychologist with that pretty extensive specialty training. You know, it's not just a rotation or a class. Whereas it can be really difficult to get in to see us, right? Because there are so few of us. And the same kind of goes for therapeutic services, counseling. Whereas there are lots of really highly skilled people here in Alaska at the master's level who are doing fantastic work. And again, it's understanding who's available for what services it is that you're looking for, which makes things more available to more people.
Mm-hmm. Roxy.
Yeah, I think it's super helpful to know kind of what you're trying to target. And so if you understand the differences and the similarities between some of our titles and our license, it can help you get and target that concern a lot quicker, instead of having to pass through provider and another provider. And so, yeah.
Okay, and Dr. McLean?
And I would actually just piggyback on what they've both said in terms of making sure that people know what your specialty area is, right? And so I know that I speak, you know, I do trauma work, a lot of trauma work, depression and anxiety work. And so I get people who come to see me for something called EMDR, or, you know, I'm also a certified hypnotherapist. And so those things, knowing when people, you know, they can actually look through Psychology Today, they can go online. And really, I tell people you should do your homework and look at someone's background. And like Roxy was saying, seeing what you're targeting, right? So we all have different specialties that we work with. And if you are, you know, in need of somebody who focuses on anxiety, you should be looking at that if you're anxious, or depression management, because all too often people do find the wrong fit because they haven't looked at exactly targeting what they need for themselves. So I get a lot of people who call me and say, I saw that you specialize with trauma and I've had this trauma history and I really need a lot of help there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And you used acronym.
Yes.
EMDR. What does that stand for?
That is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Right. And I've been doing that since 2010, and I've found it to be very beneficial for those who have had either what we call little t, small traumas, shame and humiliation traumas, or really big T traumas, like they thought they were going to die, or some, or they witnessed someone else that they thought were going to die. Some big T traumas.
Okay.
And so, yeah,
Thank you. That's what that's for. Well, you've been listening to a conversation with a licensed professional counselor, a licensed clinical psychologist, and a licensed marriage and family therapist. Three professionals with different training paths, but shared commitment to mental health and well-being. We need to head into a short break. When we come back, we'll take a closer look at training, scope of practice, and what really differentiates these roles.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Before the break, we got to know our guests and their professional backgrounds. Now we're going to dive into training, roles, and scope of practice, and help just to clarify how these professions differ. Mental health care isn't one size fits all, and that is a good thing. Whether you're looking for support for yourself or for someone you care about, understanding the different types of mental health professionals and how they can help can make it easier to know where to start and what kind of support might be the best fit. Roxy, can you walk us through the education and supervised training required to become a licensed marriage and family therapist?
Yeah. So you have to start out getting a master's or a PhD in an accredited university under a marriage and family therapy or some kind of allied mental health. So that can be psychology, that can be professional counseling or clinical counseling. And then you move into needing to get 1,700 hours of client contact. And so that's working with individuals, and about 200 hours of supervision. And that's split up between group and individual supervision. From there, you move on to getting training in certain areas. So you have to have some training in domestic violence, substance abuse, and ethics. And then we move on to a board examination. And so passing that is always kind of like the, we've made it.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Yes.
Dr. Mitchell, can you describe the training pathway for licensed psychologists?
Well, I have to admit, I don't remember the exact number of hours because I've been doing this for a while. You do have to have a doctoral degree in psychology. It can be counseling psychology. There are some other programs that can get you to that path. In my case, it was a clinical psychology program because of the neuropsychology specialty. In those programs can be 3 to 5 years. Mine was 5 for that extra year of neuro training. And then you've got, APA suggests an accredited program, an accredited 1-year pre-doctoral internship. And then for neuropsych, they expect that you get at least 50% of your internship neuropsychology focus. And then I also did a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship, because that's the requirement for a neuropsych and in getting board certified, that specializes in neuropsychology. And then, of course, you get licensed. There's all the supervision hours. I'm thinking it was 3,000 hours, but it might have been 2. Again, it's been several years for me. Then you, of course, take your ECCC so that you can then get licensed. And in neuropsychology, there is an optional board certification process that you can go through. Takes about a year to get through that. So,
okay, I know that you shared a little bit about neuropsychology, but for those that may not know what that means, could you tell us what neuropsychologist means?
Yes. So the specialty training that we receive focuses on functional neuroanatomy, behavioral neurology, neuropathology, different kinds of brain disorders, diseases that can affect cognitive functioning, motor functioning. I've done a lot of my work in Parkinson's and in graduate school, deep brain stimulation. Again, I mentioned probably the majority of my work is doing assessment and diagnosing cognitive disorders as well as intellectual disabilities and yeah, does that help?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, Dr. McLean, can you share the education and training requirements for a licensed professional counselor or LPC, as they're called?
Yes, and so with an LPC, you do have to have a master's degree in some kind of counseling or psychology background. And to become a licensed professional counselor, you have to do 3,000 hours of supervised practice, 1,000 of those being face-to-face with clients. And so it is, and they actually do not allow, even if you finish sooner than 2 years, they do not allow you to become licensed unless you have completed fully 2 years of supervised practice.
Okay. We often hear the terms counselor and therapist, and we often hear them used interchangeably. For many people, it's not clear what those words actually mean. I'd like to ask each of you to talk about your own role and scope of practice. Let's start with Dr. McLean.
So if you look at the definition between counselor and therapist in our practices, it's more about short-term versus long-term, quite honestly, right? So a counselor, a lot of times you'll see them for short-term changes, whether it's depression or anxiety or behavioral activation management. Traditional therapy is really more long-term. So when we look at the private practice, right? So I have people who have been off and on with me for many years, and they know the therapy is about coming in, you know, when they need me. And it may be a short length of time. They may always return when life gets a little more difficult or a little more challenging. And so when we think about my scope of practice, there are some specialty areas that I work in certain populations that I work with very well, and usually adolescents too, end of life, quite frankly. But I my scope is really to focus on more depression, anxiety. I have a medical psychology background, and so I do a lot with chronic illness. And I also started out as a therapist working in the HIV and AIDS awareness. And I was one of the people that actually gave patients their results in medical psych, which was a very difficult job. But it also opened me up to so many populations of people. So I'm also an ally. You know, when we look at, LGBTQIA individuals. And so, you know, I work where my background says I should work. And so I want to say that because I'm a person who's, you know, as a professor, I always remind students that you need to work within your scope of practice or you can do harm. So I just want to put that out there because I think that's very important, that as professionals we remember what our competencies are, our skills sets, and that we work within the practice scope.
All right, Dr. Mitchell.
So basically, in my practice, I think the most therapeutic piece that we do is during feedback. So after the patient has had their assessment, we've analyzed the data and come up with the diagnosis, and of which oftentimes mental health is intertwined with what they're going through. I have an approach to my feedbacks that I consider sort of a quasi-therapeutic feedback approach, because you're having to manage emotions, you're having to manage expectations, answering questions, oftentimes about very complex medical conditions, and figuring out what they're going to have to do in the future, and stressing the importance of strengths, right? Even with the diagnosis of dementia, understanding prognosis, and being able to explain that in terms that patients can understand, families can understand, and also remembering that part of our job is instilling hope in people, and that even in the face of really difficult diagnoses and prognoses, there's still a lot of hope and still a lot of life to be lived. And I try really hard to make sure that I touch on that probably more than the diagnoses during that feedback. So that's kind of how it works in my area.
All right. And Roxy?
Yeah, my scope is really in emotional and behavioral disorders that are in the context of a relational system. And so I like to use the term process consultant as kind of my role in guiding people to understand the patterns that they're caught in and how that may be contributing to their symptoms. And then we're going to work together to create a new pattern, a new cycle to help eliminate those symptoms or reduce them at the very least.
All right. So, Dr. Mitchell, you've talked a lot about testing and assessment. Could you tell us what that might look like for someone who may be referred for testing?
Mm-hmm. So there are different approaches. My approach is what's called the flexible battery approach. It's pretty common in our field, where you kind of have some core tests that tap memory, problem solving, language. You kind of really need to know what's going on. And so when people come in, there's an interview. I usually have medical records I've reviewed. And then they sit with a psychometrist who puts them through a battery of tests that I've determined is best to kind of get at the referral question. Most of those tests are paper and pencil. We do a few things on the computer, mostly just point and click kinds of things, since many of our patients are older. And then they come back for a feedback a week or so later, and we go over those results and talk about strengths and weaknesses, and recommendations that they follow up with either their primary or their neurologist for continued care.
All right. What are some things that psychologists actually test for, and why is that important?
So when you say what they test for, so we're looking at intellectual abilities, right? So knowing where someone started, which can be hard when you come in at 70 and you've never had testing. So we have a lot of empirically researched ways of kind of estimating with that. One of the common things that we see are referrals for autism spectrum disorders, ADHD. I think we've had a lot more research in the recent decade or so that really looks at ways in which we might have missed populations in the past. I actually do probably see developmental disorders in adults being diagnosed for the first time. So I do see a lot of those folks that kind of get at the crux of your question. And
absolutely. I just want to ask you about the ADHD. Sure. What does that stand for?
It's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And there are basically three subtypes of that. There's the inattentive subtype, you know, people who are basically distractible, maybe not overly hyperactive. There's the hyperactive type, which in adults, it can still be some hyperactivity. It tends to present more as impulsivity, right? Acting without thinking. And then there's the combined type, which is both of those symptoms in the same individual.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. Dr. McLean, can you walk us through what an initial appointment might look like with you?
I can. And I just want to thank Dr. Mitchell for talking about me over here with this impulsivity of mine and attention deficit. I definitely resemble those remarks. But I will say that an initial intake with me looks, especially after 20 years as a therapist, I will tell you, I am tame here, but people who know me outside of this interview know that I can be quite fun in an intake session. And I like to use humor because I believe that people have to be able to learn to laugh at themselves, right, if they want to actually have healthier outcomes in life. And so I usually start off with an in-depth narrative, right? And so I'm getting childhood background, substance abuse, medical conditions. Sometimes I'll look at doing what we call a GAD-7 for general anxiety disorder, or a PHQ-9, because I come from that medical psych background. It gives me a quick glimpse of anxiety and or depression. And so, and then I will get releases of information for other professionals, because I like to work from what we call an integrative and holistic approach. And I think because I came from the medical background, we were doing integrated behavioral health, I've kept that model. And so, you know, with me, it looks more like a conversation. I'll often tell my clients, start wherever you like, and I can catch up. And so I'm able to go through and take my notes, and we're just having a conversation.
Okay.
Yeah.
PHQ-9 stands for Patient Healthcare Questionnaire.
Patient Health Questionnaire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
9 items.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. How about you, Roxy? Would you walk us through what the first time looks like for someone coming to you for services?
Yeah. It's. I appreciate what Dr. McLean said. It's very similar in that, like, it's person-centered. I'm really wanting to get to know the individual or individuals in front of me. And we're going to go over some of those consents that they've signed and just make sure there's a lot of understanding behind that. But then I'm going to really start focusing on the patterns that I'm seeing just emerge right in front of me, usually when I'm sitting with a couple or a family, and dive into understanding that just a little bit. Because really that therapeutic alliance and them having trust that I can help them and walk with them through this is what's most important. So really tackling that for those first session and the first couple after it.
Okay, and thank you for that. Dr. Mitchell, is there anything that might look different for you as a psychologist than Dr. McLean as an LPC, licensed professional counselor, or Roxy, licensed marriage and family therapist?
Mm-hmm. Again, coming at this from a neuropsych perspective, in our clinic, we have folks fill out questionnaires ahead of time, not mood questionnaires, but, you know, kind of what are your symptoms? When did they start? What's your health history, right? Because chronic conditions can obviously affect cognitive functioning, things like even pain, which takes up a lot of space. And people who come in with attention complaints, it might be ADHD, but it also might be untreated mood disorders. It could be things like pain and chronic illness, poor sleep. So we have to go through all of those things. And then when they come in, there's an interview. I tend to be a little wordy, so they tend to probably go about an hour and a half. And then we transfer them over to the psychometrist who puts them through the testing. And then I think I mentioned this earlier, they come back and we go through that feedback period, which is kind of giving them the direction of where they go from there. I wanted to touch on something that Dr. McLean had said earlier about the importance of practicing within your scope.
Yes.
There are a handful of us here in this area that have really strong training in neuropsychology. And while psychologists are trained to do assessment, I think we also need to keep in mind that neuropsychology is more than being able to give a test, right? It's really being able to understand the underlying circuitry of the brain and how what we know about neuroscience, neurological syndromes. And so it's not just about giving a test. An evaluation is comprehensive. And so we look at a lot of those things. I know Dr. McLean also talked about the importance of the medical background. You know, my training was all in medical. I followed neurologists around for 5 years. And so I think, you know, being able to work within our scope, I mean, for the longest time until just the last couple of years, I didn't even do autism evals because I just felt that was a specialty thing. Having to get that extra training to be able to do that before I actually tackled it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I'm going to turn and check out some of our email. We have an email from Cece. I am a retired, licensed, independent clinical social worker. This is an additional, very important profession in the field of mental health. please mention this profession. Because I worked at a community health center, I was a behavioral health provider because I often went into a medical exam to help patients deal with symptoms that brought them to their medical visits, such as sleep problems, anxiety, depression, as well as developing behavioral plans to help with chronic illness. Social workers also deal with a wide range of such as substance abuse, trauma, family therapy, etc. And I just want to thank you, Cece, for your email, as we were hoping to have a social worker join us, but it just didn't work out with schedule. But definitely, we do not want to omit any of the mental health care providers in LCSWs or licensed clinical social workers, or LICSWs, licensed independent clinical social workers, approach therapy very similarly and have an expertise in systems and advocacy for their patients and clients. So we just want to make sure that we do mention social workers. Thank you so much, Cece. All right. Well, yes, and so we're taking, first of all, thank you. Often when people encounter mental health providers, they hear the word diagnoses, and we'll talk about that after our break. We've covered a lot of ground around training and licensure and professional roles. After the break, we'll shift our gears and talk about what these professions have in common, how they collaborate, and how listeners can choose the right kind of care for themselves or their loved ones. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Joining us today are Dr. Sandra Mitchell, a licensed psychologist, Roxy Powell, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and Dr. Ebony McLean, a licensed professional counselor. So far, we've talked about differences in training, and we've had an email about a social worker and what social work brings to the table. Are there any other professions that you all would like to highlight or share?
I did. I wanted to talk about, because we don't have the full representation here of everyone who works in this field. And so, you know, we're missing medical doctors who also do this work. We're missing school psychologists and social workers here who also do this work. I wanted to, when you asked earlier about what qualifies for someone to do licensed professional counseling, I also wanted to mention that you also have to take a board exam. Right,
yes.
We forget
yes.
about that part of it. Can't just get supervised. But the other thing is, I wanted to make sure that the public, I'm glad we're doing this show, because when we talk about psychologists, right, we know that the APA definition is of someone who has either a PhD, a PsyD, or an EdD, mm-hmm. right? These are all advanced degrees in psychology or some other industrial organizational psychology, right? There's so many different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And we're found everywhere, whether it's academia or private practice. Independent practitioners have to have a license, right? So you'll
Correct.
Find PhD LMFTs, you'll find PhD, LCSWs and those things. But I think one of the things that has come up in my own practice is the question about school psychologists. School psychologists are also instrumental in making sure that because they do testing on the school side, making sure that our kids are able to access independent education programs or 504 plans and those things. But I also want to make sure that people know that school psychologists are able to use the term psychologist, but many of them are at the master's level. So many times there's confusion within the greater community. I also wanted to make sure that people understood, because I think we have to have this ethical approach, that when you say you're a psychologist, the assumption of the community is that you're a licensed clinical psychologist, right? So I make sure that people know that I have a doctorate in psychology and I'm licensed as a professional counselor, which also makes me a licensed therapist. I think that people need to be able to ask those questions and get the backgrounds of the people that they want to see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Dr. Mitchell.
I know another question that I get asked a lot is, you know, people don't always the public doesn't always understand the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist. I think that's an important distinction.
Yes,
a psychiatrist is someone who's completed medical school and then had a residency in psychiatry. They are prescribing providers who are trained both in intervention and often are really focused on medication intervention. There are also primary mental health nurse practitioners who serve in a similar role in terms of being able to prescribe medications. And in our clinic, our nurse practitioner also does some therapy as well, and she's trained in that. So that's another thing for people to be aware that there is, you know, that distinction as well.
All right. It looks like we have a phone call. Let's take John.
Good morning. I'm 65, a private pilot, and wondering, is there a time that we should get a baseline so that as I worry, as I age more about cognitive decline, I know where I've started at?
Very good question, John.
So I am biased. Let me just put that right out there. One of the greatest things is when a patient comes in and says, I'm having some problems, and guess what? I have this baseline evaluation I had done at 60 or 65. Certainly no harm can come of it. And if anything, down the road, especially if there's a family history, being able to have a baseline to compare a person to later on. One thing I didn't really get into because it's kind of dull, but we have what are called normative data samples. So we know what normal, healthy adults are supposed to perform at different levels. And so a 65-year-old may have a few weaknesses compared to, say, a 25-year-old. That's normal aging. So getting that cognitive baseline is another tool in your belt or a data point for you to have should you start to have problems. And then, of course, as a pilot, that's got another level there because there are very strict FAA requirements for cognitive functioning and medications you can take. So making sure that you're safe in the air is probably a good enough reason just to get a baseline. But again, just remember, I'm biased, John.
Well, it sounds like we're shifting a little bit to similarities and collaboration and how people can choose care that fits their lives. So despite different training paths, what do all of your professions and the professions that we've mentioned share in common when it comes to supporting mental health? Dr. Ebony, let's start with you.
Well, what do we share in common? I think we share the compassion and empathy for patients or clients that we see, right? And I think that we want the best outcome for those clients, whatever our approach is. So that's where I would say I think we share those things,
absolutely,
that desire.
Yeah. And how do you collaborate with one another or with providers to support clients, Roxy?
Yeah, we get these release of information. And so this is a document you sign that allows us to be able to communicate with other providers that you're working with. And it's so helpful when we're really trying to work as a team to get you to your goal and the best results for you. So that's that first step for us.
All right. Dr. Mitchell.
At Psychology Services of Alaska, we have a broad range of different providers with different skill sets. So because I don't really do therapeutic intervention over time, oftentimes I will refer in-house or into the public for people to have therapy services, medication management. And again, when you've got that permission to talk to other providers, for me, it's often talking to physicians about their patients. It's really nice for them to be able to come to me and ask questions, for me to be able to make my recommendations back to them. So,
okay. Do any of you have an example when collaboration, like across the disciplines, benefited someone in your care?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I, you know, Roxy was talking about the release of information. We call it, you know, just an ROI. But I am the ROI queen. I make my clients give me that ROI because I want to talk to, and really when I look even at the intake, I want to, you know, if I'm seeing an adolescent, I want to know what the teachers say, what the principals observe, what the parents say, right? If I'm working with an adult, most recently, I'm working with somebody who I suspect has some cognitive decline. And so being able to make that an
And actually, being just making the referrals to like a neurologist, neuropsychology, right? Just being able to refer those clients and talk to those providers makes it easier for me in therapy session to see what was it's, well, I guess I should say what's within my scope to be able to address, right? Because you want to be able to give the best care, and our first principle is to do no harm. So that's something else that we all share. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Roxy, I see you shaking your head. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, right, we can't see everything. And so being able to refer like to a neurologist and get that assessment and understand what they're seeing and be able to talk to the neurologist or talk to a provider, even a medical provider,
Absolutely.
About what their medication is like and how that's affecting them. And so we can collaborate to kind of make the best choices or help our client make the best choices. And then even because I'm doing relational work, it's a lot of times getting releases between an individual therapist while I'm doing couples therapy or family therapy. And we're working to benefit the whole system, that individual mm-hmm. and their relationships.
Wow. So we're talking about collaboration, we're talking about training and scope of practice. I really would like to know, what are some questions that people who are looking for mental health therapy or mental health services can ask when reaching out to potential providers? Dr. Ebony?
Well, you know what? I make sure that with my informed consent, there's a disclosure statement. Right, we should be able to disclose our background, who the board is that they can contact if we're not doing our job effectively, right? But I think that people need to be able to ask their providers, what is your specialty area, right? What's your history? What kind of training have you had? I feel as though if you're on the level, none of those questions are offensive, right? They are definitely informative. And you want people to make the best informed decision for their own care that they can make.
Absolutely. Anyone else? Roxy? Dr. Mitchell?
Yeah, I really appreciate getting questions from clients. And I know in that intake, sometimes it's kind of overwhelming and they don't really know what to ask. But going in with a little bit of an understanding of what it is you would really like to target, like we come back to that question, can just help set the path moving forward.
Okay. Dr. Mitchell, how can we tell if a provider isn't or is a good fit? What should someone do if the fit doesn't feel right?
Okay. In my field, it would be, I'd say that, you know, I would love for people to be better informed about what constitutes appropriate training to call yourself a neuropsychologist, because that, I think, especially in a rural setting like Alaska really is, even in the Anchorage area, knowing what constitutes appropriate training, who knows that? The public doesn't generally know that, so we sort of have a responsibility to educate. And, you know, again, being careful in terms of, you know, the provider knowing their limitations. I think we've talked about that a few times. But again, if you're, one of the things that we had talked about earlier in terms of fit, right? And I think this is probably especially true in prolonged relationships, therapeutic relationships. Not every provider is going to fit every patient, right? And if you're in a relationship and you feel like this person doesn't get me, they don't share my values, they're not listening, you know, just because I happen to like Dansko shoes doesn't mean it's a great fit for everybody else. And I think patients feeling confident that they can make changes, they're paying or seeking our services. We are there for them. And if it's not providing them the care that they're looking for, then they need to feel that they have the autonomy to make a change. And providers should also feel confident enough to support that decision and be able to have those conversations with patients.
Right. And Roxy, what advice would you share with someone who might be listening, who may be struggling with access to care, but they need support?
When you say access to care, do you mean resources?
Yes.
Or, okay, yeah, there are some really great programs out there that kind of can help with that. Right off the bat, because I'm a part of that, would be Hope to Alaska, but there are some other entities out there that help, at least with the financial resources. But if you're needing access, like even living remote, there's so many great telehealth therapists. And so I love Psychology Today. It's like all of us in one area, and you can really put in the parameters for what it is you're needing. And if you need telehealth, like those people are right there to kind of give that to you.
Do any of you all use telehealth? And if so, how does that work in your practice?
Well, you know, I started using telehealth because I was that traditional old school therapist that you need to come to my office until COVID, right? COVID changed everything. And so now I have a lot of my clients, patients don't want to come in because it's more convenient, quite honestly, with the weather in Alaska, mm-hmm. to just do it from home. So I do both. I see people in person and I see people on telehealth. I prefer in person because we feel each other's energies, right? But telehealth is also, it also works. And here's the benefit of that. I've been able to see my clients' real lives, their pets, right? Come through and these things. And you know, so it's a different look into someone's life. So I love telehealth for those reasons. Yeah.
Well, I have so many questions for you, but we're out of time. And as we're winding down, I want to give you just a moment to share your final thoughts or key takeaways. Let's start with Roxy.
Yeah. My final thoughts, just my hope in anybody listening is that they were able to just better understand our disciplines, our titles, and to walk away knowing that you don't have to really know where to start. Like if you start with anybody, they can guide you. It can be very overwhelming to kind of go down a mental health journey. And so being able to just like call out for help is the first step. Yeah.
Well, our thanks to our guests, Roxy Powell, Dr. Ebony McLean, and Dr. Sandra Mitchell. And just a reminder of resources available in our communities around the state. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is a nationwide support line for anyone in crisis. State-level use has been notably high in Alaska. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producers, Rachel Cassandra and Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.